hold back to themselves, but most of the words have, I guess you'd call a conjugate word or something. So it gets a little bit hairy there, but that's some of the information. But it's FSK, according to this.
Well done, Lou. Good information. And once again, it's another one of those situations where, boy, there is a mountain of information that's available to us on the Internet these days. And that Wikipedia, boy, do I like them. Wow. So it looks like you search on those words plus the word Wikipedia or Wiki, and it looks like you're going to get a lot of information there, Dave. And it looks like you're going to become an expert in the subject, and you'll get a chance to add it to your electronics if you want to. And if so, keep us informed as to how that project is going. Sounds to me like you'd like to set up a system where, for instance, you and your wife can talk to each other, and only you and her will know which code you're using. Therefore, her receiver will only give you your voice, and she don't have to listen to everything else that's on channel all day long. That's just one of the many ways you could use this thing. KC2, Romeo Papa Echo, K2RIW. You got it, Dave.
Wow, okay. Thank you very much. Hit pay dirt here, trying to get an idea of what I'm dealing with. So, that's right, I'm going to hit that Wikipedia up and try and understand yet one more feature. Here's some real ooh-ah items here on these rigs. Thanks a lot. Back to the net.
This is just another one of those examples of fancy kinds of modulation. In the early days of radio, you sent Morse code by turning the carrier on and off, and eventually we added amplitude-modulated audio, and voice was coming through. And eventually, after Armstrong did his thing, before he died mysteriously, we invented FM modulation. So you either took the amplitude or the phase rate of the signal, angular modulation or amplitude modulation, and we thought those were the ways of putting information on the carrier. You start studying the techniques of what's going on with cellular telephone these days, 16QAM and QPSK and IDENT and, oh man, the Reed-Solomon techniques and so on. You think modulation is simple. In other words, there's a zillion ways you can simultaneously change the amplitude and or phase of a signal in order to transmit your particular kinds of information with other hidden pieces of information in there as subcarriers, supercarriers, and so on. You study what goes on with NASA, for instance. For me to listen to the Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 astronauts, and you can read about that in the... You can read about it the way I did it way back in the dark ages of 1971. This was in the 1972 issue of QST magazine, the June issue. This is called Houston, This is Apollo. You can see the fancy pieces of electronics we had to hook up in order to get those subcarriers of audio that were off the main carrier of data plus biomedical. That was being sent down by the command service module and the lunar module and so on. So the word modulation is becoming a lot more complicated these days. Okay, we're running a little bit late, unfortunately. The next person was Barry, N2 Moon Bounce. Go right ahead, Barry. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Uncle's proud of you.
Are you there, Barry? Okay, the next person was Lewis. Kilo Bravo 1, Victor David Bravo. Go right ahead, Lewis, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thanks. So I'm pre-planning my shack, which at the moment the most convenient place is going to be on the second floor. So I have two basic questions for you. One is there a preference for running the cables? There's a hole in the basement from the indoors to the outdoors I can run antenna cables through that and then up interior through the house to the shack on the second floor, or I could run them on the outside of the house to a window pass-through. So which is the preferred method and why, if there's any pros and cons? Second question is, if I do run them on the outside, there's power lines running where I would want to run the coax cable. Would a foot between the power lines and the coax cable be okay in terms of interference? This is KB1 ZDB. Thanks.
Very fine, Lou. should you run all of those cables between the inside of the house or the outside of the house? As long as you're willing to drill holes in the floors and the walls and whatever, and then there's various ways you can cover it up, I would prefer indoor wiring, because any way that you come out of the house, weatherproof it, go back into the house and weatherproof it, a little bit of a problem, a lot of extra problems in that. If you're going from the first floor on the north side of the house down to the second floor on the south side of the house, now life gets a lot more complicated. And should you wrap it around the outside of the house or the inside and try to go through all those rooms and whatever and lay it along the sides of the walls? There's a lot more variables involved. I'm gonna be throwing it over to K2KEY, Mel, because I know that he's run into problems like this. His house is heavily wired. So his backyard is heavily wired. His front yard is heavily wired. So he's had these problems of how to run that wiring. When it comes to 110-volt wiring, how close can it be to the coax cables? Assuming you're following the codes for the proper insulations, I think they can almost lay side by side, particularly if the 110-volt wiring was in its own conduit. Then they could the coax cable could wrap around the outside of the conduit, and you wouldn't be violating any code, or you wouldn't be violating any radio interference problems. Let me drop. Your power wiring really is a twisted pair, plus the third wire for a guard or ground or safety. So, as such, your normal power wiring is itself pretty well shielded, even before you add the outer conduit. When you add the outer conduit, you're doing it for safety to make sure that no one's cutting through it by stepping on it by mistake or whatever. So, when it comes to the 60 cycle radiating into the RF coaxial cable, that's almost a non-worry, if you know what I mean, because the power wiring is pretty well shielded. I think they can be very close. But as I said, I think Mel probably has been through these. I think Mel's been through these problems. I bet he's got a lot of opinions on it. K2KEY, how would you do it, Mel? K2RIW in the second half.
Okay, good evening. This is K2KEY. Well, you know, I believe in going the shortest path. My ham shack is up on the second floor, about the middle of the building, and the windows face south. And so I more or less arranged the antennas in such a way that I could basically bring all the cables in through. I drilled through the wall. I didn't put any window type of this. These window type devices for double hung windows that you can close the window down on it. Now I figured I went through the wall, and I'm not really. Some people say, well, boy, going through the wall may making a hole. Well, I'm not going to be as concerned when I leave if there's holes in the wall. I'm sure the next person around, most likely anyhow, they've been knocking houses down here, left and right. I haven't seen any house been sold here that's old, that's as old as this house, that will survive, new people. So not going to be concerned. So let me let it drop and I'll describe what I've done. Okay, the coax cables come through, as I say. I drilled a hole, individual holes, actually, to bring in, it actually evolved, so I kept adding cables, and every time I just went through the hole through the wall with my carbide hammer drill, and then packed the outside so that no little buggies can walk in, or water, or whatever. And then the feed-throughs, I have these porcelain feed-throughs for the open wire feeders. So, coming around, you're going to start running a lot of cable and start going downstairs and try to go back upstairs with it. I don't think that's ideal. I think if the shack is on the second floor, ideally you put it up there on as short as possible. As far as going near the 110-volt lines, if your drop line, I assume what you're talking about, when it gets to the house, I'm sure it's got a conduit that leads down to the basement where the meters are, or the panel is, the fuse panel or the breaker panel. So I don't think that you'll have any problems being anywhere in that area with coax cables that go over.
It's also possible that Lewis is worried about even the wiring that's in the wall, not necessarily the drop line that comes from the service drop into the masthead of the house, or what is called the weatherhead. He maybe is talking about the other internal wiring of the house. I think it's not much of a problem. In inch of spacing, I think I would feel safe with. If they really laid parallel to each other and held together with tie wraps, I think that would be pushing it a little bit too far. I don't think you're going to get hum pickup in your electronics, because as I said, the wiring for the house really is twisted pair. It's a balanced network. The amount of current flowing on the black wire and the white wire are essentially equal to each other, and therefore the external field is pretty much canceled. But I like your idea of keeping it short, and there's no exact way of doing this. There's no way of doing it wrong, as I see it, Lewis. No matter how you do it, your highest priority is to keep the wife happy. Your second highest priority is to be beautiful enough that you're pleased with it. Your third highest priority is to make sure that the insulation isn't something that the friends visiting you start to making jokes about it, if you know what I mean. Your fourth highest priority is to worry about the exact length of the wire and the signals that are lost. I guess I would put further up on the list of priorities is how easy it is to service. No matter how many coax cables you run, no matter how many antennas you got, no matter how many power lines you've got, 5 years, 2 years, 1 year from now, you're going to be increasing it if you're a really active ham. So try to keep it as an adaptable system. And I presume you're not transmitting from Ilford, Maine right now. I presume you're at your more southern house. Is that true, Lou? KB1, Victor David Bravo, KQRIW in Effectnet.
KB1 BDB, yes, that is true. I am in Brooklyn now, but I was up to the house last week, and that's what I'm basically doing in April, is planning how that shack is going to work out, and have some photos of the house, and good to hear the power line running up the side of the house. The input from the telephone pole that's running, I guess, down the side of the house to the box isn't going to be a problem. It looks like a fairly new installation, so hopefully that shouldn't be an issue. I think outdoors to a window feed-through might be the most ideal situation. Definitely K2RIW and K2KEY, both your advice you gave is fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah, do make double darn sure, Lou, as you're installing the antenna, whether it be a mast, a tower, whether you're using an aluminum ladder to do the installation or whatever, make double darn sure that there is no way that any portion of the antenna can fall onto the drop line that goes between your house and the utility pole out in front of your house. You don't want any piece of substantial metallic objects falling on that or coming anywhere near the power lines that are on the utility poles themselves. It's extremely easy to electrocute yourself, and one or two hams per year in the United States die in that manner by having a tower falling across a power line, whether it be the utility pole power lines or the drop line to the house. So there you got to be careful. But for what you're describing, I think you're fairly safe. Mel, it's time for your mailbag. Sorry, we're a little bit late tonight. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, roger. Okay, let's see. Let me read down some here. I've had a hard time. It's so busy this week with so many things. So I'm really reading them for the first time here, and I'm going to scan down. Let's see. Okay, here's a quickie. I just got a transmitter that I bought secondhand, and it seems to work fairly well, except I don't know what kind of microphone to use. It says in the instructions to have a high impedance microphone. I have a large collection of microphones, but I have no way of knowing if they are high or low impedance. Is there an easy way to determine this? Okay? What would you suggest, Dick? Over.
Yeah, make sure your transmitter is on full power, Mel. I'm hearing a tiny bit of scratchy noise in the background. You're 95% audio and 5% noise. Also, your audio could be a little bit heavier. I don't know if you're speaking to up to the mic as close as you normally do. So you could use a couple of dB more audio also. But you sound good. That's a worry. I guess I'd like to believe that most of the microphones that you're going to get a hold of have a brand name and a model number. And now with the Internet, we can look up almost everything. So there's ways of looking for the data sheet from the manufacturer of the microphone. That's one approach. Another approach is that even if it is a low impedance mic and you put it into a high impedance radio, it's not the end of the world. The worst that'll happen is the audio gain will have to be set a whole lot higher, and in most cases that's recoverable. I've seen a number of rigs where somebody got a hold of an extremely high performance microphone, which happened to be a low impedance microphone, and he plugged it into the high impedance port of the radio. After he turned the gain up high enough in the audio circuits of the radio, it sounded beautiful. There's also ways of putting on a matching transformer. They used to, in the old days, have these tiny little black, old, 3/8 of an inch diameter matching transformers, which had a primary winding and a secondary winding, and you could adjust the impedance of the microphone any way you want by hooking up that tiny little transformer and hiding it inside the microphone or inside the radio. So these are some of the approaches. By way of the testing, no matter, even if you've got a microphone that's rated for high impedance, and you've got a radio that's rated for high impedance, and you just hook the two together, in any case, you're going to be doing a number of tests to be sure that the audio level of that particular mic and that particular radio is coming out correct. So the minimum you're going to do is ask somebody, let me drop. You're going to ask somebody on the air, how do I sound? Am I loud enough? Am I over-modulating? Am I distorting? Does it sound clear? And there's various ways. In the case of an FM radio, it's very easy to take a second receiver that maybe you don't even have to connect to an antenna, and you put on a set of earphones, and you listen to the second receiver while you're transmitting out of the other rig into the antenna. The nice thing about FM is the audio still comes out nice and clean, even though you're transmitting nearby, and you think you're overloading the receiver. With FM, you can do that. Unfortunately, with AM and sideband, you cannot. In general, in the same shack, you want to listen to your particular AM transmitter with another receiver. Almost always, you'll be overloading the receiver because the transmitter is so darn close, and you'll get distortion, which is not real, if you know what I mean. So tell me some of the ways that you've solved this problem, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I'm thinking about this. Well, quick way. Let's go by a simple quick way, known as, you know, usually my simple, so-called simple ways, sometimes work quite well. All right, if you connect this to your radio, as it said, Dick says, nothing's going to burn out. You're not going to do any damage to the radio. And let's say you get some reports that the audio is very low with that mic. This would suggest possibly that the impedance mismatch and will most likely usually indicate the mic is of a higher impedance than the rig requires. And so again, I will say it. In other words, the audio is low, and the mic most likely then is of a higher impedance. This kind of mismatch, and will indicate that's why your audio is low. Most of the ham rigs, however, in the last few years, I'm going to say if this rig is, say, within 5 years old. Now, mostly all the new ham rigs are using low impedance input with a simple audio device. So if you're taking microphones, let me let it drop and I'll tell you about old microphones. If you get, like, old microphones, like they used to use on the, tape recorders and things of that sort from way back, those mics were sold, those crystal mics, they used to sell them or give you with the equipment for small tape recorders and all, they don't work well. Don't bother with any of those mics. Some of those mics were meant for a completely different situation. A high impedance input. Most of the rigs now, I could say in the last years, are low impedance. That's about all I can think of, Dick. Over.
Yeah, many of the microphones these days have a preamplifier transistor built into the microphone, acting as, I guess, an emitter follower, giving a fairly low output impedance that then drives the radio at the end of the cable, the microphone cable. So it's going to require some experimentation and some research to find the right wires, put them to connect them to the right pins or the right kind of a connector on the end of the cable. I mean, if you've got five microphones in the house and you just bought a brand, you bought a radio that's brand new to you, but it's used, which I think is the case, the chances of any of the mics you own having the right kind of connector on the end that matches the radio is pretty slim. And even if it's the right kind of a connector, are the pins the same? So it's going to take some research to go to Radio Shack and the Bubble Packs and buy the right kind of a connector is one approach, or go to a good flea market where they're selling these connectors that you put on the end of the cable. So, and hopefully you've got a schematic that came with the radio so you know which pins are hot, which pins are ground, and so on, which pins are the push-to-talk on the microphone. So microphones are a little bit of a pain to get it all to work right, but there's lots of ways of doing it, and I wish I knew of an article that specifically addressed this. I don't remember of a section of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, but I'll bet you if we Google the words microphone interface or adapting a microphone to a transmitter, or adapting a microphone to a ham radio transmitter, you Google some of those word combinations, guarantee you're going to find articles on the subject, and that's going to help. But I don't remember a particular section of any of the ARRL manuals, the handbook, particularly addressing this. Do you, Mel? K2KEY? Yep.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Answer that one if you can. And if not, go on to the next question, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
I got some info, J2EO.
Go ahead, Rich.
If he goes to Heil Sound, H-E-I-L, they're a manufacturer of amateur microphones and commercial microphones. They got a lot of information on their website, and they also sell a matching transformer, go high to low, low to high. I think it's about $10, and so we help.
Don, good suggestion, Rich. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to check on that Heil Sound. One of the best sounding audios I've ever heard was a particular ham who used to live in Farmingville. Unfortunately, he became a silent key, I think it was last year or the year before last. And he had put one of these equalizer networks between his microphone. He chose a very good broadcast quality microphone, and he put one of these equalizer networks in the line between the mic and the radio and carefully adjusted it so that, boy, he sounded like a radio announcer in a good studio, if you know what I mean. And I'd like to do that because I know that my audio could be improved. For whatever reason, it's sounding a little bit muffled tonight. And it's not because I don't have the processor turned on. There's the processor turned off, which is really muddy audio. And there's it turned on. So I can make some improvements. Over to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
That sounds pretty good on this end, Dick. I don't hear anything unusual with it. As far as power, no, I'm up to 50. I got it at 50, 55 watts, I guess, maybe, because the little pass between me and the repeater site is a little different tonight for some reason or another. All right, let me see. I'm looking for another one here. Okay, here. Yeah. Okay, I want to build my own tuner. I see a lot of components at the Ham Fest. In fact, I picked up some nice variable capacitors and coils and all. The only thing I'm curious about, if I put this tuner, I build this tuner into a metal cabinet, what is the proximity of the variable capacitors in regards to the cabinet itself when mounting it? In other words, what effect does the cabinet have on the capacity of the plate? I guess the capacity, you mentioned the capacity of the rotor in assembling a tuner. In other words, you take the capacitors, you put it in a metal box, what happens to the capacitors? That's over.
Yeah, I just discovered that I skipped somebody. Ken, if you're there, AB2, Whiskey Charlie, I just realized that I skipped you, and so right after we finish with this particular question, I'm going to go back to Ken. I hope he's still with us, and he's somebody who signed in, and we didn't get to him by mistake. For the most part, when you put a capacitor in a metal box, if it was an extremely small capacitor, one that was miniaturized and it's only got three plates, an air variable capacitor, I guess I would want to make sure that the sides of the box are more than, let me pick a number, a quarter of an inch or a half inch away from the capacitor itself, because the near proximity of the sides of the box could be adding stray capacitance to your variable capacitor, therefore lowering its dynamic range. In other words, if your capacitor normally tunes 5 to 10 picofarads, it's a real small, very few plates capacitor, it tunes from 5 to 10, and you make the mistake of mounting it in the lower left-hand corner of a metal box, and it's only a 16th of an inch away from the walls of the box, instead of your capacitor tuning from 5 to 10, you may get 2 extra picofarads from the walls, and now it'll tune from 7 to 12. And so therefore, if your network had to work at 5.5, and now it's the minimum you can go to is 7, that could be a little bit troublesome. But that's a rare case. Most of the air variable capacitors I'm familiar with, the individual plates, the rotors and stators, are so close together in the spacings when they're meshed that capacitance highly dominates, and the little bit of stray capacitance you get from the walls of the box is a very minor secondary factor. So as long as when you rotate it, the
repeater, timeout, cancel.
As long as things don't touch each other when you rotate it, as long as you've got enough spacing to do that, I think it's pretty hard to get in trouble. I think this is almost a no problem. What do you think, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Yeah, most definitely. Actually, as I said, the minimum capacitance of a large variable capacitor is more limited by the factor of the stray capacitance. However, the only thing that you have to be cautious of if you want to build your own tuner and you're putting it into a metal box, that the maximum voltage may be considerably higher than at the transmitter output due to impedance loads. So you got to be careful, that give some clearance that you don't get an arc over from the capacitor as you mesh it out to the cabinet, maybe the cabinet's, height, that you got to be careful when the variable starts to open up, that it don't come close, say, to the top of the cabinet or however. In other words, that's the only thing, is the spike voltage that you may have there. And so you want to try to give a little, make sure it's clearance so that you don't have a possibility of an arc. That's about all I can think of, Dick. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a good point, Mel. Also, I was using a nice miniature capacitor that had the right value for the 300-watt 6-meter transmitter that I built way back in the early days of 1970s. And my variable capacitor, which is part of the Pi output tuning network, and this was the tuning capacitor, not the loading capacitor. The tuning capacitor, which is the one that was connected to the tube, and the tube had 2,000 volts on the plate. So this capacitor had to see 3,500 volts in each direction, almost 7,000 volts peak to peak was being applied to this particular capacitor. And from time to time, the capacitor would arc over from rotor to stator. And by the way, when you hook up a variable capacitor, do worry about polarity. In other words, whether your highest voltage goes to the rotor or the stator, try to make the highest voltage go to the stator, and the rotor plates have the lowest voltage, because that's also connected to the knob that goes to the front panel. And there's a bunch of reasons why that's the safer way to do it. But I was getting arcing between the rotor and stator plates within the capacitor itself. And I couldn't find another capacitor that would fit in that location that had greater spacing and still had enough capacitance. And I got around the problem by taking sheets of Teflon and placing them in between the rotors and stators. I made up a whole lot of little sheets of Teflon, cut them just to the right shape, and put them in between all of those plates. At first, that didn't work. Let me drop. At first, I was getting arcing right through the Teflon. And I suddenly found out that there's Teflon and there's Teflon. You buy virgin Teflon. It doesn't have pinholes, and there's no problem. You buy reprocessed Teflon. It tends to have pinholes. And that RF energy will find those pinholes and arc through there. So as long as you use what you know is brand new virgin Teflon, and you buy the right thickness of Teflon, and you put those sheets in between the rotors and the stator plates, that arcing that I used to have, the problem went away. So there's lots of solutions to this problem. Even if you're getting arcing between the capacitor and the chassis, you can put a sheet of Teflon or some other high voltage standoff material in that vicinity and stop the arcing, and you might not even have to remount your capacitor. Lots of ways to skin the cat. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Yes, very good point, Dick. And usually, I just say, Dick has brought up a very good point. Usually what you do is make sure that the shaft that comes through the panel has what they call a decoupling type device. In other words, you don't want that shaft coming through to the knob. That's a no-no. You'll always find that there's a coupling in there, usually a non-metallic coupling of some sort between the variable and the shaft that goes out through the cabin. Okay. Anyhow, very good. Dick, you want to pick up that other station you said you missed before we go on over?
Yeah, let's do that. I hope Ken is still with us. Alpha Bravo 2 Whiskey Charlie, if you're still there, Ken. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Question about installation, and that runs contrary to ideas about that.
Okay, I'm hearing Ken very well on the input, and Ken is asking us questions about when you're using a linear amplifier, particularly in an automobile. We are always recommending that your automobile transceiver and an amplifier, an afterburner that you add to it, that the by far the safest way to wire them is to have a black lead and a red lead, a nice heavy gauge that goes all the way back to the battery, with a fuse on the negative lead and a fuse on the negative on the positive lead. When you're wiring to your high power amplifier and the wiring to your transmitter goes right back to the battery, you pick up about three or four benefits. Number one, the biggest filter capacitor anywhere in your automobile is that battery. That's the equivalent of a 10 farad capacitor as far as filtering out any alternator wind that might be on your transmitter otherwise. Second of all, the twisted pair of black and red lead with the 20 amperes flowing through it to your 160-watt amplifier, the twisted pair going right back to the battery is a self-shielded structure. And many of these Mirage and other kinds of brands of afterburner, linear amplifiers, have nowhere near the right amount of bypassing of their B-plus input, the 12-volt input leads. If they really added the right kind of a...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
If they really added the right kind of a filter feed-through capacitor at the Mirage transmitter, that would be an extremely expensive device and they wouldn't be competitive. As such, they've got a very simple bypass network, you know, a couple of disc ceramic capacitors and a feed-through plastic thing. And so you take your 160-watt Mirage amplifier, when it's running 160 watts output on 2 meters, you do a careful measurement, and you're going to find there's a couple of watts of RF energy on 146 megacycles coming out of that 12-volt wire. You will discover that. That wire going into that package is acting like an antenna, coupling some of that signal from the inside to the outside world. And by having that twisted pair of red and black lead going all the way back to the battery, it becomes a shielded structure, and therefore you're not radiating that signal into the car. It's very convenient and common sense to say that why should I run two leads? I can run the B-plus 12-volt lead to the transmitter or to the amplifier, and the car has got a whole lot of metal surfaces nearby. I simply ground it right there. You do that, and your 12-volt red wire is going to be doing radiating. The automobile is going to have some funny currents, both RF and DC currents, flowing through the battery, flowing through the frame of the car, and the net result is a much higher probability that your emission control computer and your computer that gives you the display on the instrument panel, any one of those computers can be picking up RF signals and doing some funny things. In the case of the emission control computer, I've known of guys who find out that when they turn on the transmitter, the car will stall because the emission control computer gets confused. So for a whole bunch of reasons, I highly recommend that you run a pair of leads all the way back to the battery. Let's see if Mel's got an opinion on that one. I'll bet you quite a few of the guys have experimented one way or the other with
repeater timeout.
I'll bet you the Kings County Radio Club has done quite a bit of experimenting with various ways of doing that. And I bet you they've re-derived that so-called truth. Isn't that true, Russell? K-E-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
K-E-Y again. The reason, really, with that fuse in the negative lead, a lot of people have questioned me over and over about this. Why can't I just ground it to the, conveniently to any place where there's metal in the car? Don't do that. And I'll tell you why, and why you need a fuse in the negative lead. We've gone through this again. If for any reason you get a bad connection from the black lead or the negative lead of the battery where it goes to the block of the engine, that is the part of the path for starting the car. Now, if you were have that lead with any way to come loose or whatever, the path now is going to be through your radio or from any of that piece. In other words, you're going to provide a path that negative lead that you're using if it doesn't have a fuse, it's going to light up. It's going to be drawing all that current right through that your negative lead that is going to be grounded at your rig, and something is going to be damaged somewhere in wiring or your rig is going to be burned physically from the current. So this way, if that negative lead that goes to the engine block that's usually there just to make contact for your starter, to return the ground for the starter, if that is open and you go to start the car, the negative fuse will blow before anything glows. That's a very important factor that the people don't really realize and a lot of times pass up on. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to amplify that a little bit. When you run that starter motor, it draws something in the vicinity of 200 amperes. If you don't have a fuse on the negative black lead that goes back to your battery, right at the battery, along with the fuse that you've got on the red lead, the positive lead, with any error in the wiring in the car, although it's a low probability case, you would run into the situation where 200 amperes would try to flow through your black wire back to your rig. And you really don't want to do that. Guarantee your rig won't be happy. So although there may be amplifier manufacturers who recommend another kind of wiring, I'm reasonably sure that almost every automobile manufacturer will tell you don't install radios in the car. But if you do install a radio, make sure that there's a twisted pair all the way back to the battery. I'm reasonably sure with all of the experience that we amateurs have had on that one that 99% of the time that's the right way to go. And try not to depend on the grounding of the amplifier or the transceiver at the body of the car itself. Back to you on this one, Ken. AB2, Whiskey Charlie, K2RIW in the TechNet.
AB2, Whiskey Charlie, back in TechNet. Thanks for the information. I was reasonably certain that that was the proper procedure to run everything back to the battery directly and not go through chassis ground, because, you know, you're screwing up with the computers and the car and everything else. So if I do a mobile installation, I certainly will do that, and I thank you for your information and your feedback on this. AB2WC, back to TechNet.
Good luck with that installation, Ken, and come back and let us know how it turned out. Let's give one more try to Barry, N2 Moon Bounce, to see if he's here. N2 Moon Bounce, K2LIW. Okay, he got called away. If you've got one more you think is a good general mailbag unit that you communication that you had, Mel, go right ahead. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, there's a question. I've been reading them over, you know, trying to pick out something that's of interest a little bit, you know, off the beaten path a little bit. I have obtained a radio, very reasonable, and I assume that static electricity or whatever got into the front end, because I found that the MOSFET in the front end was burned out, and also the voltage, variable voltage diode. Oh, it means a varactor diode, I would assume. The diode is bad. Is there any way I can find out the diode, really what its rating was, if I have another one in the radio that looks exactly, has the same markings, but I can't seem to cross-reference it? Can I take out this diode, the good one, and anyway measure exactly what its rating? In other words, he wants to take a varactor diode and know what its capacity is. Is there a way of doing that simple? I'm not sure, Dick. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a couple of ambiguities on this particular question, Mel. And maybe by what you can read, we may be able to figure it out. Because he's had a MOSFET transistor in the front end become damaged, and lightning can do that, or some other error that allows transmitter power to be applied to the receiver, that can blow out the front end transistor. Also, many of the modern day rigs have diode switching. Instead of having a transmit-receive relay to flip back between the transmit mode and the receive mode and come out to the common connector that goes to the antenna, many of the modern-day rigs have diode switching, and a person may, by mistake, call that a varector diode. In most cases, these are PIN diodes, P-I-N diodes. And so, just the fact that there's another diode in the rig somewhere that has an identical look to it, is it the same? Well, if it's the diode switching that's in the front end of radios, quite often it takes a minimum of two diodes to do it, so quite possibly those two diodes are identical to each other. And maybe one of them's got burn markings, but it's got the exact same physical package. And in that particular case, if the two diodes are co-located and they look like they're part of the solid-state transmit-receive switching function, then there's a high probability they are identical PIN diodes. People may call them varector diodes. I'm not so sure it's a varector. Normally, the varector diode is used on the voltage-controlled oscillator to tune frequency. And most of the time, they do not use varector diodes to do transmit-receive switching. I could be wrong on this one, and Rich N2EO and others will correct me if I am. So it'd be very nice to get a hold of... Let me drop... It'd be very nice to get a hold of the schematic diagram from the manufacturer of the radio. A service manual, the owner's manual. The owner's manual almost always gives you a schematic diagram. And most of the time, those diodes will be marked as to what part number they are. You got to be a little bit careful on the transmit-receive solid-state switching function. You would like to use an extremely similar diode there. Any old power rectifying diode probably will not do the function. That particular diode, I'd be kind of careful. And as I said before, most likely it's not really a varector diode. It could be, but not likely. So it's going to take some research. Once you know the rig brand name and the rig model number, a Kenwood TRTS 711A, for instance, That's what you're listening to me right now. And with the right kind of web search and checking with your ham radio enthusiasts, you will eventually get the owner's manual and/or schematic diagram and/or service manual, and you'll get a lot more information of using the right diode. Be a little bit careful on that particular diode. You'd also like to use something very similar for that transistor you're going to replace, and notice you get the same performance without going through a whole lot of retuning procedure. If I just plugged in any old RF amplifier transistor to the one that was there, yes, I could make it work, but it's going to be require some extra tuning to make it work on all of your bands, if you know what I mean. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
From what I'm reading here, no, it definitely was a Vera. He was able to get some information. It's a company, you know, one of these, what I'm going to tell you about, some of these rigs that are come through, you know, some of these companies. I don't know who they were or what they are, and they were marketed under different names and things. But he says it's definitely, according to this, it's definitely been identified that it is a Veracta type diode. It is a Veracta diode. And the only thing they could not give him, he could not get from a source. I don't know what source there, but they said that there is another one that's used in the radio, has the same markings on it, the number, the first number and marking is the same. And he says he could take that out, but he'd like to know how would he go about measuring this diode. If it is the bulge variable diode, the bulge Veracta diode, is there a way you could measure a Veracta diode, if that's the case, as to its capacity, minimum and maximum, Dick? I'm not sure. Over.
Okay, you're good, John.
Eric recognized. I'm going to go over to Eric in a minute. Okay, let's assume that it really is a Veracta diode. And he is suspicious that the Veracta diode has been damaged. And usually when a Veracta diode or a pin diode, a Veracta-like diode is damaged, it will fail a diode test. In other words, if your digital voltmeter has not only a ohmmeter scale, but it's got a way you can click it into the diode testing mode, which means it puts more than one volt across the diode. See, many of the ohm meters of a modern-day digital voltmeter operate on something like a quarter of a volt. And a quarter of a volt in the forward and reverse mode will not put a silicon diode into conduction, and therefore it looks like an open circuit all the time, and you get no information. Whereas the modern-day digital voltmeters will have a diode testing mode, which puts something like one volt on the diode, and now you can really see forward and reverse resistance and confirm that it truly is a diode. You only have to lift up one lead out of the circuit, make one lead free of your diode in order to perform this test. I think there's a 50-50 chance he will discover that his two diodes that are in there for the solid state switching, they might not have become damaged. They might be in good shape. Let's see what Eric's got to say. KE2EJ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Also in Julia.
M2JTV, listening.
Hi, Dick. There's a couple of radios I know of where they use reactors in the front end to you know, go for maximum sensitivity. And it's pretty rare. They're not even made by Japanese manufacturers. They're not even a ham radio. But there's a possibility that they do that. The other thing with reactors is the linearity. Different varactors have different slopes, so, you know, just measuring the capacitance is not necessarily going to get you what you want. K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, and we're going to pick up Rich Neck. Now, I can think of ways of putting a varactor diode with a bias voltage on it through, let's say, a 40K resistor acting as an RF choke, but putting the voltage on the diode, and you've got another coupling capacitor, and the combination of the coupling capacitor in series with the varactor and the varactor itself, putting them across the terminals of a capacitance measuring digital voltmeter. A number of the digital voltmeters will measure capacitance. So by sweeping that voltage through the 40K resistor in my example of the varactor diode, you could be switching the voltage between, let's say, minus 1 and minus 20, and look at the slope of capacitance versus voltage and confirm that varector diode number 1 and varector diode number 2 closely track each other. That is a possible test. And if you can get a pair of diodes that act nearly identical, assuming there are identical diodes in that solid-state switching network, and maybe they're not. So measuring capacitance versus voltage with the right kind of digital voltmeter is a doable thing. I didn't say it's easy, but it is doable. Let's see what Rich has got to say on this. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2EO, let the ID go by. Think some of the ham rigs actually did use, not a lot, but a lot, some of the radios did and do use varector diodes with an associated tuning voltage as you go up and down the 2-meter band or 70-centimeter band. For instance, one that comes to mind, you remember the Yaesu FT221 and the 225, the next radio up? They had a tuning voltage when you would switch the band segment, 500 kilohertz segments from 144 to 147.5, and go up the band. There was a tuning voltage which would change the capacitance on the varactor in the front end to keep the sensitivity level across the band. And it was very, very critical when you tuned up that radio, you had to set the tuning voltages exactly. And with a good bench DMM, otherwise the whole thing would get screwed up. I found that out the hard way, Dick. And by the way, I forget where we got them from. When we got a reset. Make a note to F. Howe, K6DPZ. He knows. He showed me about a month ago, he picked up from a company in California. They got them from China. A digital LCR meter reads inductance, capacitance, resistance I remember the capacitance was like from less than a picofarad up to, you can read electrolytics with it. $28. Plus the shipping, which was a few dollars. I wish I remembered the company. I bought one right away, Dick. Go ahead.
How long have you had it? Are you happy with it? Rich, go ahead.
I am extremely happy with it. Hal was so happy he bought a second one. He came down my basement. We took some 5% silver micas, like 7.5 picofarads. They read exactly. In fact, on the 62S1 I mentioned, it looked like the choke had been rewound. I measured it; it was 5 microhenries, and they called for 7 microhenries. I was able to wind a little more wire and make a 7 microhenry choke.
And all that for $28. Boy, that's a goodie. Okay, so Hal, K6 Delta Papa Zulu, is a man who knows about this company in California selling this beautiful $28 LCR meter. Sounds like fun. So as I see it, there are ways of confirming that the varector you've got is good, but the varector you want to substitute if you think it's bad has a similar characteristic. And yes, Rich has brought to my attention that Yaesu FT221R. I've owned one of those. That rig was one of the most bulletproof front ends I've ever seen on a 2-meter rig. And the reason for it is it had a tracking filter front end. It had a big rotary dial in the front panel where you selected the nearest 500 kc of the 2-meter band. In other words, you tuned it from 144 to 144.6, and then from 144.5 to 147. You know what I mean. It tuned in 500 kc chunks, and as you went to each one of those trunks, it was selecting the voltage on this tracking filter front end. So therefore, the rig only let in the right frequencies. Many of the 2-meter all-mode rigs that we use and 2-meter FM rigs, the front end is wide open across the whole 144 to 148 meg band simultaneously and a little bit beyond. And so you may tune to 144.1 talking to the sideband guys, and somebody puts on a real whopping big signal at 147.9, and it overloads your rig even though you're nowhere near tuned that. This Yaesu didn't have that problem, where many of our other rigs do, because of that tracking filter front end with the variable voltage on the Varecta diodes doing this tuning. So there's better ways of doing it all the time. Okay, sounds like it could very well be Varecta, and it looks like it's going to take a little bit more research to fix that front end. For a crafty amateur...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
For a crafty amateur to buy a non-working rig, where as long as somebody hasn't been cannibalizing it, as long as it's really got the all of the parts inside, but just that a lightning strike or a transmitter by mistake was nearby and put a lot of RF energy in the receiver mode and blew out the front end transistor. For a crafty amateur, that's a relatively easy fix, particularly when you got a guy like Andy, WA2CDL, who runs all of the tune-up clinics at any of the Limoc functions. He can fix anything. So with a little bit of enthusiasm on your part and or the help of Andy, it's hard to get a rig that's really a lemon. And as such, you can save a lot of money by buying a non-working rig. And you may buy a rig that's worth $800, but you pay $200 for it because it's in non-working order. And with $20 worth of parts and an hour of your time, you got it back in working order. That can turn out to be a very good deal. I bet you run into a number of those, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I sure have. In fact, listening to one right now. This was a salvage job. Came out of the garbage pail. I got a few of them that were literally garbage in the garbage. Just happened to get there at the right time and was able to grab off and summon them. Were really high-end, nice pieces of equipment. Fifth or sixth, but no less they were well worth the effort. And so I can think of at least three of them now that I've done. This one here is the Kenwood. And it's good on an age now. It's a 2-meter radio. I did an FT817, which was a misery to work on because of its size. But a real piece of a gear when you get finished with a beautiful QRP radio, covers everything. And then I did another one, a Kenwood TS830 with blown-out power transformer, brand-new radio that was inadvertently plugged into 220. Blew the transformer up, and so on and so forth. So every so often you see these deals, and if you get a reasonable price, they can be fixed, but you got to be able, have test equipment, be patient, be able to, you know, do certain things like have to chase down parts and all. And listen, it's not a quickie in many cases, but possible, as Dick says. Okay, Dick, better go on to after 10.
Out of curiosity, Mel, how's the mail been running this week? More than usual, less than usual, about normal? Over to you, Mel.
It's calmed down quite a bit. Some of them give us complaints, you know, that their questions never get on the air, or they, you know, we don't devote enough time to this part of the tech net, but... Well, listen, like you said, we never promised that, you know, everything was going to be letter perfect, so we do the best we can, Dick. There's a lot of these questions I'm not going to get into. I have to skip over a tremendous amount of it, but within reason now, over.
Yeah, we are adaptable, and we know that we can't keep everybody happy, no matter which one of the sections of the TechNet we emphasize. Somebody's going to be unhappy. Let's see if Paul's got a report for us as to what NASA is doing this week, if Paul's on frequency. Whiskey 2 November, our space expert, K2RIW. Are you there, Paul?
Yep. And listening to the net, good net. A couple of things. Tomorrow you've got a launch from Kazakhstan. They'll launch another expedition crew up to the space station, Dick, so You know, we don't talk much about that, but there's three people going up, three coming down. Three will come down before the others go up.